Before we start, we appreciate councils being able to shuffle your schedules, and we're delighted to be here with you. This is a very familiar courtroom because this is where we would sit when Judge Irving Goldberg was alive and on our court, and this we would come here and sit with him, so it's like old home week. We'll call the first case, United States versus Goss. Ms. Nestor.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Catherine Nestor. I'm an assistant federal public defender from Jackson, Mississippi, here on behalf of the appellant. We have before the court this morning a case of first impression where the question presented is, in cases involving mortgage fraud, where you have immovable, real property as collateral securing the mortgages, should the district courts subtract that collateral when determining the loss amount under Section 2B1.1 of the Federal Sentencing Guidelines? We submit the collateral should be deducted for three reasons. First of all, in looking at the history of the Sentencing Commission's amendments to these economic crimes, it's clear that beginning in November of 2001, when there were major changes made, and that is the version of the guidelines that we're applying in this case, the commission was focused on what is the actual financial harm that's being caused by these crimes. It became very clear in the new amended guidelines that they were taking what was really looked at as a net loss approach to financial crimes, and that the net loss reflected directly on the culpability of the defendants. We cited in our brief where there was, during committee deliberations of the new amendments, the committee spokesperson in speaking on the commission's seminar on this issue said there was unanimous agreement in the committee that there should be offsets for collateral in cases where the collateral is part and parcel of the fraud. Well, that's a typical mortgage fraud case. In a mortgage fraud case, the whole fraud is surrounded by a mortgage, which is secured by a home and a piece of property. There have been cases, the second reason we think that supports deducting the collateral is the history of the cases in this circuit. This circuit has looked tangentially at collateral issues, but never in the context of immovable real property that all parties agree is there, it's real, it has a substantial value. Frequently, it has a value that exceeds the amount of the mortgage. Most mortgage lenders won't give you a mortgage that's in excess of the value of your collateral. So most of these loans are fully collateralized. All parties at the point of the mortgage, at the closing, all parties are aware there's real property, it's there, it's secure. Worst case scenario, if this person defaults, which is the argument that the defendant intends, in other words, they're getting people to get mortgages who can't afford them, who shouldn't have them, with the realistic proposition they may default on these mortgages. But all parties at the time they entered into that and tried to get this borrower a mortgage fraudulently, everybody knew that worst case scenario, the bank's gonna own that piece of property and that house.
Well, that's my question, because I suppose just in general, you would always deduct the collateral, but there's something different here. The government, prior to sentencing, moved the court to determine how it would decide this issue. I believe there may have even been, and you responded, and I believe there might have been a hearing in July of 07 or something. Y'all referenced that in your briefs. And the judge decided that he would include the entire amount of the mortgage as the loss, either actual or intended. I guess this would be intended. So, and I haven't seen an opinion by Judge Wingate, I don't believe. So what was his, I suppose, I do think I've seen part of an order. What was his rationale for why he did this? Is it because many of these mortgages were to persons who should not have received the mortgage in the first place?
No, sir, Your Honor. Both Judge Wingate, and interestingly, in this record, there's also attached to one of the government's pleadings an opinion by Judge Barber. Both of them believed that the status of the law after Morrow in this circuit required that if there is a third person pledging the collateral where the defendant himself doesn't have control over whether the collateral is made available to the lender.
They did that, it on the basis of Morrow and Sanders.
Yes,
and they
sir.
They thought that the Fifth Circuit law controlled.
Absolutely.
So would you discuss why the Morrow and the Sanders decisions are not controlling and why the judge may have been in error with respect to
it? First, yes, sir. I'd be glad to. The first question about Morrow. Morrow came down before these amendments were made to the financial crime. So I do just point that out for purposes of putting in perspective how the circuit was looking at these financial crimes at that point in time. It was 1999. In the Morrow case, you had a situation where the defendants were getting fraudulent loans, financing for mobile homes. Mobile homes where they're mobile. In other words, there's no way to secure or ensure that if everything goes wrong and these people default, as they certainly were likely to do as a result of this fraud, that the harm would not be the whole loss of the mobile home. You can put a mobile home on the back of a pickup and drive it to Canada, and it's gone.
That's my question. And again, I know Judge Wingate was relying on Morrow, but here you've admitted that many of these people should not have received this mortgage. That was part of the fraud. And we don't know what's going to happen. It's easy to say, well, the house and the property will be there. But we don't know what's going to happen when these people default on these loans and what sort of loss the lender is going to take, especially with the economy as it is now and the housing market as it is now. That's my point. We just don't know for certain what's going to happen with this collateral. Yes, it'll be there, but what's going to be the value? What's going to be the loss? And all the judge's decision has to be as reasonable.
The interesting part of that issue is that the guidelines talk about how do you value collateral. Do you look at what the defendant thought it was worth at the time that the fraud occurred? And the guidelines instruct probation and the courts to look at the value of collateral at the time of sentencing. So the court, again, is returning to this net financial loss idea of at the point of sentencing, what is the net financial harm? Regardless of what you thought it was worth at the time you committed the fraud, it's where are we today? What loss has been suffered, and how should you be penalized?
So at the time of sentencing, the value of the collateral at the time of sentencing would bear on the intended loss?
Yes.
I mean, because you really don't know what it's going to be.
Right, and that's the problem.
On the other hand, if he had pledged it himself, you wouldn't know what it was going to be either.
No, you wouldn't.
So we import at the time of sentencing.
Yes, sir.
Well, that was last summer, right?
I mean, well.
Sentencing was 07?
Yes, sir.
Right. But again, going back to my point, these mobile homes, we knew what their collateral was valued as at the time of sentencing. We just didn't know what the lender could recoup the victim. And that's my question here. How do we know what's going to happen as far as the value of this property? For example, you read of how when homes are repossessed these days, people, the owner who's in default goes in and just trashes them.
Right.
And wrecks them. And the lenders have to spend all sorts of money. So to avoid that, the lenders sometimes let them keep the property. I mean, it's just not cut and dried. And perhaps that's why we accord the clearly erroneous standard of review to the total loss. And that's why I'm very interested in reading this record of this hearing. And I do want the parties to make sure we have that July 07 transcript, if there is one.
It was supplemented, Your Honor. The reason it was lost is that there was two defendants being heard at the same time, and they filed it under the other defendant.
Right.
But we did recover it. It has been supplemented. I would disagree respectfully that this court should apply the clear error standard in this case. And that's because Judge Wingate bifurcated his ruling. And
I understand.
Ruled, okay.
As I understand.
Let me ask you a question. What is the significance of the finding of conspicuously indifferent and reckless about whether third parties would pay as opposed to whether the collateral of third parties would be available? is the significance of that language in Morrow?
I think that's hugely significant, and it distinguishes Morrow from our case importantly. And that is this: both in Morrow, in McCormick, in these are all cases where you were talking about securing mortgages on vehicles, mobile homes, all of which, as a defendant, if I set up a bogus loan and then I wash my hands of it and I have no control over what happens to the collateral, if it's shipped to Canada, if it's driven away, then I think there is a substantial reasonableness to a court saying, hey, you were reckless about whether this would ever be repaid. In a situation in a mortgage fraud, where you have a mortgage broker who has an appraisal in front of him of a house worth $350,000 and the borrower is getting a loan of $300,000, I think there clearly is a distinguishing difference between whether or not it's reasonable for the broker to believe that if the worst happens and this person defaults on the mortgage they should never have had to begin with, you're going to own a $350,000 house, so the risk I'm exposing you to is the difference between
what you lose. Well, you're talking
about
what the broker believes, aren't we? If we're talking about intended loss, we should be viewing it from the standpoint of the defendant, shouldn't we?
My defendant was the broker.
Oh, he wasn't.
Yes, sir.
But the amount, the value, appraised value at the time of closing, you know, we could almost take judicial notice it's going to be a whole lot less,
sure,
at the time of sentencing because of the downtown and the,
sure,
downturn in the housing market. It just gets back to my concerns that it's not as cut and dried as you would want us to believe that, oh, well, Mara is a mobile home and this is, you know, real property. I think that there may be a lot beneath the surface here.
Well, I would point out to Your Honor that if the value of the property goes down between the time of the crime and the sentencing and the lender loses more money, that's to the detriment of the defendant under the current state of the guidelines, which says, we look at it right now, and if it's gone down $100,000, that's your bad, defendant. You should have foreseen that it could have gotten worse. So his loss amount
is
increased.
Who should have foreseen it should have gotten worse?
The defendant. I mean, it goes to the defendant's detriment.
They didn't go out and appraise these 35 parcels for sentencing, did they?
Well, if this court, no, because the judge ruled, I don't care what the appraisals say, under Morrow, I can't deduct collateral because he had no ownership in these. So we never got to that point in this case.
So if we remanded this for resentencing, should we order that the 35 parcels be reappraised to have the value as at the time of sentencing?
We actually talked about that at this hearing that you're going to read in July. And we came to the conclusion that what other circuits have done have looked at assessed values at the time of sentencing, which is just the tax assessor's value right now of where this property stands. That would be a very simple way to do it. If a defendant wanted to bear the burden of challenging that the assessed values were too high, which most of us homeowners usually think is the case, they could go hire their own appraiser and put on evidence at sentencing that of what the current appraised value is, but that would be to the defendant's
cost. Often the appraised value is far below what the actual value of the property is.
That's true, and that's also the assessed value.
These windshield appraisals that
that's
the taxing
right.
authorities do.
That's right.
Counsel, was the handbook note and interpretation that you cite in support of your position, was that same handbook interpretation, did that exist when Morrow came out?
It's similar, very similar. Intended and actual loss did not really change all that much between the time of Morrow and the amendments, honestly, in 2001. They were still doing that analysis of what constitutes an intended loss versus an actual loss. Our position in this case is it's one and the same, because the collateral should be deducted. And then you look at, okay, if there's default, what's the difference? And that's what the government does at sentencing day. I'm sorry. And we strongly also feel that the trends in the other circuits are supporting this recognition of collateral. The 1st, the 7th, the 8th, the 9th, the 10th all recognize that collateral is important to intended loss, that courts should look at it. Some of them, there appears in the 6th Circuit that they have qualms about it if the defendant doesn't have direct ownership in it.
Would the court determine that? Would it be determined on the quality of the collateral? In other words, should the court consider whether it's mobile property or not, whether it's real and fixed, and whether it's located in a marsh area, or whether there's misrepresentations about the collateral? I mean, is it a cut and dry thing, or how would you have the court fashion what the court should consider?
Intended loss is a pretty vague concept that you're already placing on the district courts to come up with anyway. I mean, you're asking a district court to determine a subjective intent of a defendant. Sure, I think the court should look at, is the collateral movable? Was there a clear, reasonable belief that this would be there if the lender had to default? I think all that should be, I think all of that should be considered by the district court, but that's being considered now. You're not adding any burden to the district court, because right now a district court has to make a finding about what is an intended loss. And that's a factual finding that, once that finding's made, we're up to the clear error standard.
Well, let me ask you one question, then you'll get your full time for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's assume we did remand for resentencing on what the loss amount should be. Is there any dispute about whether it's actual or intended? Would that make a difference?
I don't think it does in this case because of the facts, because if it's a mortgage fraud. I think in other cases it might make a difference. I don't think it does in this one.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Cleveland?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Gaines Cleveland with the Gulfport branch of the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Mississippi.
Glad you were able to make it out and get here. Thank you.
Thank you, thank you, Judge. I actually had evacuated to Jackson earlier in the week under mandatory evacuation, but we were able to make it back home. Thank you, Judge.
Give him all his full time, 20 minutes. Go ahead, sir.
The trial court correctly applied the sentencing guidelines commentary as written in determining the loss amount. The court's determination also is consistent with the law of this circuit. The guidelines commentary provides for a credit against loss only if the collateral was provided by the defendant. Goss says that the court erred by failing to deduct the loan collateral, but the defendant provided. He pledged no collateral. Thus, he is entitled to no credit.
Except on his one loan.
Except on his one home. And there's a difference. If you have ownership in the collateral, you have an interest in the collateral, a vested interest that makes you want to protect that collateral, make sure the insurance policies are paid up, make sure that the property is in good condition. But if you're getting loans for third parties, you don't have that kind of interest.
Counsel, let me suggest a scenario in which the third party pledges a security or an account in a bank. The bank is advised of the lien on the security or the pledge of the security. Would you say that the fact that the third party pledged a security or actual cash or maybe a CD, that the defendant shouldn't get credit against the intended loss because it wasn't the defendant's CD?
I can only respond, Your Honor, with what the federal sentencing guidelines commentary, which this court recognizes as authoritative, says. And it says that the defendant only gets credit if the defendant provided the collateral. That's what the law says. And that is consistent with the law of this circuit in cases involving other types of collateral. Now,
well, if it's that cut and dried, I was interested in this. If it was that cut and dried, why did the government feel it necessary pre-sentencing to move to have a ruling on the methodology to be used?
I cannot account for.
Well, what did the motion say?
The motion, basically, it was clearly going to be contested by the defense. And I think that the parties wanted to have an opportunity to flesh this issue out because it affected directly how the probation office would frame the pre-sentence report.
I mean, this sort of pre-sentencing hearing, I'm not, I don't recall seeing it.
It is unusual. It's clearly unusual. This came on the heels of a similar case before Judge Barber that was referenced earlier, and counsel opposite can probably illuminate this better because she was there on the front lines. There was clearly an interest in trying to flesh this issue out because it affected so directly how the probation office would frame the pre-sentence report.
Now, after this, after the motions and then this hearing in July of 07, at sentencing, I understand the defendant objected again. Is there a lengthy discussion at sentencing about this issue?
I will be perfectly truthful. The record had been returned by the time I got this case on that particular point because I think it got filed separately. So I cannot speak directly to that issue. Now, Goss, of course, relies on the federal guidelines handbook to state the position that the defendant accepts, but the guidelines handbook is not the guidelines commentary. It's not the guidelines, and it should not be relied upon. The case law in this circuit distinguishes between situations when the defendant intends to repay a fraudulently obtained loan and has control over the collateral, and when the defendant does not. Counsel for Goss says that this court has not ever addressed the question about what do you do in cases where real property serves as a collateral. But in the case of U.S. against Tedder, which is cited in the government's brief, this court upheld using the full loan amount of the mortgage for real property loans and automobile loans because the defendant there, as here, was obtaining loans for third parties and had no control over the repayment of the loans. The same is true of U.S. against Morrow, and the fact that it was not a situation involving anything but mobile homes, as Counsel for Goss points out. But that did not enter into the discussion, and Judge Barber was asked to address that particular question. And this is in the record that says that the court has been asked to make a distinction between mobile homes and houses in this case, but the court can see no reason to do that. The distinction that this court has drawn is between a defendant who owns the collateral and a defendant who does not own the third party owning the collateral, which is what the situation is here. And in Morrow, the court considered that the repayment of the loan was not in control of the defendant, who were given no credit against loss for the collateral they did not control. And similarly, Judge Barksdale in U.S. against Hill, which you authored, this court wrote that the defendant was entitled to no credit against loss because he had no ownership in that case in the securities.
What's the year of the Hill decision?
It was under the 2F1.1, the prior.
But it's under the changes to the 2001 amendment.
That's correct.
What is the significance? Why? If third-party collateral cannot be used as a credit on intended loss, just across the board, cut and dry.
Okay. Well,
why would Morrow have even said consciously indifferent or reckless about whether third parties would repay the loans? It wouldn't make any difference under your view whether they were conscious, whether Morrow was consciously or different or not. It just wouldn't be allowed.
Well, if the defendant has the intention to repay a loan, it's a different story. If the defendant owns the property and has an interest in protecting the value of the collateral, it's a different story. And that's a distinction that not only the guidelines commentary and the present guideline makes, but also is a distinction that this court in its case law has made. In this situation, the defendant made the borrowers look more creditworthy than they were. The defendant didn't care what happened to the collateral in the hands of the third parties. if something had prevented the lender from recovering the full value of that collateral, the defendant could have cared less. Couldn't have cared less.
But the collateral would be there if it's fixed. I mean, as a practical matter, we all know that if you have a movable object like a car or a mobile home, it is going to depreciate. You have blue book values that'll tell you if a car is 3 years old or 4 years old, and you have calculations. You buy a Cadillac, how much it's going to depreciate in the first year. We know as a historical fact that that mobile or movable assets, that like it was involved in Morrow, that they are going to depreciate. There's no historical fact with respect to real estate. As a matter of fact, our whole market is driven by the fact that we ought to invest in real estate because we know that historically over time it doesn't depreciate, it appreciates.
That is true, but not necessarily true in any given moment in time. We happen to be in a moment of time of particular uncertainty in the real estate market. This is a defendant who didn't care anything except getting the money out of the mortgages for the third parties that he brokered their mortgages for.
How can he intend for that not to be available when he would know that whatever the fair market value of that collateral is always going to be available?
It's his indifference to it that's really the issue here.
Did Judge Wingate make a finding of indifference in this case?
His order is included in the record. It's document 41 in the electronic case file, and it basically indicates that he's going to go with the intended loss amount, which is an amount which looks to the financial risk associated by the defendant's conduct, and that's the language that he used on page 2 of that order. That focuses on the financial risk. The situation here is obviously the question is did he leave the lender exposed? The lender does have some ability to recover collateral, but valuing that collateral throws all sorts of uncertainties into this process, and it's not something that this defendant had an interest in keeping up the value of the properties, and that's the distinction.
Well, is the middle position here then that there should possibly be remanded for resentencing and at that time provide the court with whatever the defendant wants to urge and what the government wants to urge as the value of these 35 parcels as at sentencing?
Your Honor, I don't think so. I think that the guidelines commentary is absolutely specific that the credit against loss in a situation like this is only for collateral pledged by the defendant. And so we're still at the same situation. The court, of course, gave this defendant credit for his own collateral. I don't think that this is the time.
That clear cut, why'd the government go to all this trouble to have a ruling pre-sentencing before the probation officer even prepared the pre-sentence investigation report? That's what I don't understand.
I cannot speak to the thinking of the AUSA who presented the matter. She's no longer with our office, not because of this, but that's because life moved on. I cannot speak to that. I do not think that this is the time to be erasing the bulk of the sentencing guidelines exposure, and I don't think it's the time to be lowering the penalty for defrauding mortgage lenders. And we believe that it would create a whole host of problems in valuing the collateral in these cases, that this is not the time to lower the penalty for committing mortgage fraud.
Note 2EII refers to actual loss calculation. Now, what do we do here where it's on intended loss? Why would, even if you're correct, that it only applies to collateral pledged or provided by the defendant and not third parties, why would that rule apply, that limited rule apply not just to actual loss calculations, which seems to be the focus of that provision, but to an intended loss calculation.
Your Honor, I don't think that the distinction is in the guideline that Your Honor is referring to. That is to say, there is under this guidelines 2B1.1 application note 2, which addresses loss under subsection B1. It has a general rule and then other specific provisions, including this section 2E, too small I, credits against loss. I don't believe that that is restricted to actual loss calculations. I think that applies equally to intended loss calculations. We ask the court to affirm, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Nestor? Ms. Nestor, if you, what do you recall at sentencing, the discussion again about the value to use? What was the objection? What did the government say and what did the court say?
You're talking about the final sentencing
yes,
after
ma'am.
Judge Gerenge did his preliminary
yes,
ruling. Really, the only thing that came up, Your Honor, of course, we reasserted our right to object to this at appeal. We did advise the court that the day before that day, this court had come down with the opinion of United States versus Wright, literally the day before the final sentencing. In the Wright case, the defendant, this court did in fact allow a case to go forward where the collateral was subtracted. It was a mortgage broker. It was on point factually, but I did inform the judge that there was the issue of whether collateral should be subtracted wasn't brought up to the panel.
It was just something that happened.
And that's right, and the government didn't object, and it went forward, and this court found no plain error, and we brought it to the court's attention. I conceded that I didn't feel like it was precedent requiring him to reverse his prior ruling because the court didn't specifically address it, but clearly this court signed off on that type of analysis the day before, and I brought that to the court's attention. The court, both Judge Barber and Judge Wingate, make it very clear, and I think you'll see when you read the argument on the 19th as well as Judge Barber's opinion, and Judge Barber very candidly said he felt constrained by Morrow. He didn't agree with it. He thought collateral should be subtracted, but he felt that Morrow completely prohibited it. So there is some guidance needed. There's a whole slew of mortgage fraud cases behind me where this issue is going to be decided over and over and over again, and we're having the same argument in every courtroom. I disagree with my colleague from the U.S. Attorney's Office that it is that clear cut even in the application note. In the application note, the language is, in a case involving collateral pledged, and then there's the phrase, or otherwise provided by the defendant. There's an argument here that the otherwise provided by is the only thing the defendant modifies, and that collateral pledged is not necessarily restricted to the defendant. So, of course, I don't agree that it's that clear cut, even in the application note, that credit should not be given. I do think there have been some cases that have determined that this application note only applies if you're visiting an actual loss analysis rather than intended loss. And again, as I did concede in this case, I think it's for all intents and purposes the same amount.
Counsel, you've indicated that the other circuits are going along with your view of this issue. Are there any other circuit courts that have interpreted Morrow or come to the same conclusion tomorrow to decide the question with respect to third-party pledged real estate collateral?
I don't know that they used Morrow in their analysis. I definitely there's cases that trend with Morrow. The First Circuit clearly went the opposite way of Morrow and granted third-party collateral deduction in the McCoy case, which I know I've gone on and on about in my brief. But as far as whether there's the circuits were actually citing tomorrow as authority, I didn't find that.
Any other circuits coming to the same conclusion without, I mean, to the opposite conclusion of McCoy?
The Sixth Circuit seems to hold that if it's a third party, and this is my interpretation, it's not real clear in the Sixth either, but I would probably concede the Sixth Circuit has found that if the defendant doesn't own the collateral, he doesn't get an offset for it. But the other circuits that I have seen all consider the amount of control the defendant had over collateral as a factor, but not a prohibitive factor. In other words, it's just something the court should look at sentencing to determine what was the intent of this defendant.
The proofs are ultimately going to be in if we send it back. The judge still may very well feel that he didn't really care whether it was paid off, and that was just incidental. He couldn't control that collateral and not give him credit. You're not saying that he is automatically entitled to the credit, are you?
Well,
I mean, you just cited me a standard that suggests that it's not automatic.
I would submit that the application note does suggest that you are entitled to credit for an offset. Of course, though, I recognize that a judge has full discretion to determine what he or she thinks was the intended loss. I do think you're automatically entitled to an offset if there is secured, immovable, real property backing up a bogus loan that you know the lender can get their hands on. I think you're entitled to an offset for that. But I recognize that I recognize that the subjective intent at the time of the closing all can be looked at by the court when determining, you know, perhaps whether there's a departure appropriate, perhaps whether the sentencing range is reasonable. But I think at the start, you subtract the collateral.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
All right, we'll call the next case of the day.